It turns out that the light bulb business might be a better idea than the finance business. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, October 14th. We're happy you could join us. We begin today with General Electric, which has been as much about high finance as washing machines since the late 1990s, but not anymore. GE announced this week that it's selling another major piece of its GE Capital Finance arm. Wells Fargo will buy $32 billion worth of commercial loans and leases. Ultimately, GE plans to unload most of its $500 billion financial operations. Those have included credit cards, loans, and a whole range of other stuff that got GE in big trouble during the financial crisis. And Wall Street hasn't liked it much since then either. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
Until GE started unloading its finance units earlier this year, they accounted for nearly one-third of the company's revenues. But it didn't used to be that way. After World War II, GE made refrigerators, generators, light bulbs. Then legendary CEO Jack Welch took over. It was 1981, and Wall Street was being deregulated, and big money was taking off.
This was the light bulb, so to speak, that went off in Jack Welch's head.
Jeff Madrick is author of Age of Greed, with a chapter on the new GE and Jack Welch's thinking.
Why should I be in the industrial business when I can make such a high return on investment in finance with far fewer people? And he started to move the company away from these industrial companies, which were very people and worker intensive.
In the next few decades, GE made lots of money financing real estate, private equity, credit cards. Then 2008, the crash. GE's huge exposure led it to take government help. Wall Street didn't like that. It liked what came next even less, says Jeffrey Manns at George Washington University Law School.
2013, the Financial Stability Oversight Council designated General Electric a systemically important financial institution, equivalent of a bank holding company.
And life is hard for bank holding companies right now, says Jim Corridor at S&P Capital IQ.
The regulatory environment is very harsh. They spend a lot of time on compliance, and they have a lot more government oversight as a financial company than they would as an industrial company.
For GE, it's a transition back to the future to focus on making things like aircraft engines, medical devices, and power generators again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Water is obviously on the minds of Californians, and deep into the state's four-year drought, water bottlers have become a big target for conservation groups. In the latest battle, environmental groups are suing the U.S. Forest Service for letting Nestle pump millions of gallons of water out of a California national forest. Now, water bottlers in California don't use a lot of water, relatively speaking, but they also don't pay very much for it. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more.
Nestle, it turns out, is hardly paying anything at all. And when it comes to how much you pay for tap water relative to your electricity or cell phone, you don't either. Most of us take it for granted. Junaid Ahmed is Senior Director of Water at the World Bank.
Water is such an emotive and political issue. It's sort of equated with life, and therefore one does not like to see it as a commodity. And yet by not making it an economic product, you actually misallocate it.
Ahmed says around the world, the poor pay much more for water than the average household does in the U.S. Now the drought in the West is making people think about how they use water.
People have been promised cheap water, endless water forever, and at some point that water has run out.
That's David Zetland. He wrote the book Living with Water Scarcity. He says it's going to take a while to change attitudes and realistically treat water as a finite resource here. And the bottled water industry isn't the one to blame. It's just an easy target.
California, they should be talking about how water is being used in the environment or how it's being used in farmers. But instead, they focus on one permit in one national forest from Nestle, which is just wrong.
Agriculture accounts for nearly 80% of the nation's water use. Farmers in California have been hit with reductions, and so have the state's cities. Junaid Ahmed thinks the onus might be on industry, agribusiness, and water bottlers alike.
And I think that that kind of signal by the big water users that they're investing in protecting water sources, whether you're a Coca-Cola or you're a Nestle, is good business for them.
At least that's what Starbucks thought. In May, the company announced it would move its water bottling business from California to Pennsylvania. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Shares in Walmart saw their biggest drop in over 15 years today after the company told analysts its earnings could drop as much as 12% in 2017. Walmart says this is for a couple of reasons. It's planning to invest billions of dollars in its internet technology infrastructure so it can compete with e-commerce giants like Amazon. It also blamed higher wages for its workers. The company has been struggling to increase sales. It can't really cut prices any lower, and it's not expecting a lot of growth anytime soon. The four members of the Walton family, who control the majority of Walmart shares, lost about $9 billion in combined net worth today, thanks to that stock drop. We have a couple of stories about Walmart's attempts at reinvention and more on that pay hike. That's at marketplace.org. And bad news for Walmart was bad news for the rest of the market today. We'll have more when we do the numbers. More than 181 million people did not visit a dentist last year. It kind of makes you want to hold your breath on the subway, doesn't it? That's according to the American Dental Association. So you'd think the ADA would be all for expanding the pool of people who can help us take care of our precious choppers. But they don't love this latest idea. Dental schools may soon start training a new kind of provider, somewhere between a dentist and a dental hygienist. They're called dental therapists, and proposed legislation in 10 states would let them drill, fill, and extract teeth, jobs usually reserved for, well, dentists. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
A couple years ago, back pain forced Dave Kuchar to leave his job in an accounting office in Vermont.
You know, the whole story is, you know, that when you lose your job, you lose your insurance, you lose your ability to take care of your teeth, you know, especially your teeth.
Money was tight. It got to the point where the best Kuchar could do was rub some gel on his teeth to numb up the pain in his mouth.
Gums were really red and sore. It's hard to chew sometimes, especially with the broken teeth in the back and stuff, you know. I was ready to have my teeth out.
Everyone agrees. There are too many stories out there like Kuchar's, where it's too hard for too many to take care of their teeth. In a report to Congress last year, the ADA said more than 2 million people showed up in the ER with dental pain in 2010, double the number from 2000. Some people believe one solution to at least improving access can be found here.
Okay, so once everybody is ready, and actually before you put your gloves on.
30 dental hygiene students are in class at the Vermont Technical College just outside Burlington. Today, the women are using a pressurized water jet to break up plaque on each other's teeth. Vermont is one of 10 states that's considering a bill to permit dental therapists to practice. It's passed the state Senate, and if it becomes law, hygienists would do a year of training here to get a new license. The idea, says Professor Sheila Bannister, is graduates would get hired by dentists and get busy.
This is going to free the dentist up to do more complex procedures. The dental therapist is going to be doing the simplified procedures.
Bannister says patients would still have to pay the same whether they saw a dentist or a therapist, but it would at least be easier to get an appointment. It would also free up dentists to focus on the most complicated cases, the ones that bring in the most money.
I don't see why it couldn't be a win-win for the dental office and the patient. I mean, it just makes sense to me.
I just don't believe dentists see this as a solution.
Dr. Judy Fish is a past president of the Vermont Dental Society. Dentists have successfully fought tooth and drill around the country to block laws allowing dental therapists. Fish says it's not that the dentists are protecting their turf, it's that they're protecting their patients.
We take pride in what we do. We spent 8 years in postgraduate education getting to that point. And I think expecting that someone can be as competent in 1 year is offensive.
If the country's serious about getting more people care, then the ADA says there's a better fix. Pay dentists more to treat poor people. One study found improved access in Texas, Maryland, and Connecticut after the states boosted payments, cut back on Medicaid paperwork, and helped match patients with dentists. Advocates are all for that, but they say hiring therapists helps too. They point to Minnesota, the only state to license therapists. Before dentist John Powers hired one, he saw 15 to 25 new patients a month.
Last month we had 234 or 54, I can't remember which one it was.
With that kind of jump in his business, Powers doesn't need to keep count. Since he's hired dental therapists, he now has three, revenue's doubled, and he's opened a new office. But what really excites the advocates, this expansion is being driven by Medicaid patients, who now make up half his practice. It used to be 10%. Powers isn't an anomaly. A state report found a drop in wait times and more Medicaid patients getting care. Powers knows a lot of dentists are worried, which is why he's throwing his doors wide open.
It's kind of like, well, come on out and see what's going on. We'll share our numbers with you. It's not a big deal. It makes sense.
Powers says therapists aren't taking work from the dentist. It's just the opposite. Business is so good, he's planning to bring on another dentist. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
When you think about what makes a great video game, you probably think about the graphics, the pictures on the screen, maybe the story, but spare a thought for the voice actors, because their performances can make or break the experience, and they could go silent if certain industry practices don't change. Negotiation time is coming, and the union that represents voiceover artists has authorized a strike if they can't reach a deal with video game makers. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has the story.
Video game voicing has come a long way from the days of Altered Beast.
Rise from your grave.
Timothy Seppala covers the business of video games for Engadget. He says today,
I would say that the voice actors are an incredibly big portion of the game.
He points to cinematic, character-driven games like The Last of Us.
Does anyone come in here?
No, who would come in here?
The vocal performances are just incredible. Like, I almost cried while I was playing the game.
As the roles have become more demanding and the video game industry has ballooned into a $90 billion business, voiceover actors who work for flat fees want more, like bonuses for games that become blockbusters.
I'm not some, you know, fat cat rich actor. I'm struggling to get that next gig. So that's why residuals are important to us.
That's DC Douglas. He's the voice of Wesker in Resident Evil and Legion in Mass Effect. He says voice actors also want limits on the number of consecutive hours they're expected to scream or make death cries.
It's exciting to do and whatnot, but it also trashes your voice, and it trashes your voice for other work.
Neither the big video game companies like Electronic Arts and Activision, nor the union, SAG-AFTRA, will comment. Dave McNary, who's been covering the back and forth for Variety, says the industry's in a tricky position.
It's a little bit of a dangerous area because these games, of course, some of them are very popular.
And some of the most popular have multiple sequels. Game makers don't want to alienate their fans by giving new voices to characters they already care about. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the brutal fact of market competition is that it is your enemy if you want to get rich.
So competition is bad. That and other secrets of becoming obscenely rich. But first, let's do the numbers. It was Worry City on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 0.9% or 157 points to close at 16,924. The Nasdaq gave back 0.3%, that's 13 points, to close at 4,782. And the S&P 500 let go of 0.4% or 9 points. It finished at 1994. The big culprits were blah bank earnings, weak retail sales numbers, and concerns that the Fed may hold off even longer on raising interest rates. First, the banks. J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew 2.5%. Wells Fargo was off 2/3. And in other earnings, Netflix had a weaker-than-expected quarter, and its shares plunged more than 7% in after-hours trading. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.9%. And you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. So here is a statistic from the Urban Institute that caught our attention. Since the Great Recession, 1 in 5 Americans has become asset poor. That means if you take everything they own and you add up the value, it would be less than $6,000. Well, in Portland, one nonprofit is looking to combat asset poverty. The organization is taking one of the pillars of Western capitalism, the strip mall, and turning its ownership into a social project. Oregon Public Broadcasting's John Sepulveda reports.
Don Luthy wants to invest, but she's got barriers. She just lost her house to foreclosure. Her credit's bad. She was injured on the job. And right now, Luthy works at an apartment complex where the landlord pays her in housing. Still, she's seen a couple investment advisors.
You know, they say, yeah, $5,000, $10,000 to invest. I don't have that kind of money.
Enter Plaza 122. It's a strip mall, a three-sided strip mall with a parking lot in the middle. Names like Allstate, Hair Salon, and Chimney Repair are painted on the small store windows. Of course, there are some who see something much bigger than the run-of-the-mill strip mall.
This, in my mind, is where Marx meets Milton Friedman. You know, it's making the market work for everybody.
John Haynes is the executive director of Mercy Corps Northwest, a humanitarian nonprofit. And essentially, this strip mall is his vision. One of Haynes's big priorities at Mercy Corps is to alleviate asset poverty, i.e., find ways for people who normally don't invest to invest. So Haynes pulled a team together and started talking to people in the community.
We asked them, do you invest? Would you want to invest? What kind of investments would you be interested if you did?
The answer? Real estate. Mercy Corps Northwest bought the strip mall for $1.2 million and set up a real estate investment trust. That's a complicated financial tool utilized by mega investors. But Haynes says anyone in the neighborhood can buy a piece of it, including renters, people with bad credit, anyone.
If a grandmother, a couple lives down the street and has been here since the building was built in 1962, they can be an investor as well.
Here's how it would work. Investors would take a financial class, then put in 10, 20, or 100 bucks a month. Time goes by, appreciation goes up, strip mall tenants pay their rent, and voila, the investors get a dividend. And while it's small money in investment circles, Haynes says it could be a big deal for people seeking financial security. In this neighborhood, about two-thirds of people rent their homes. Noella Nettesel is a professor of economics at Reed College in Portland, and she's helping oversee the project.
I think this is taking what's great about markets and investments and making it available to people who otherwise face barriers.
But Nettesel says it's not really Marxist. After all, people putting money in aren't guaranteed a return, although she adds that this program is not really about big returns.
Do they break that cycle of poverty? What benefits do we see to their children and grandchildren? So it's a long-term investment, helping people get onto a better trajectory.
But here's the $1.2 million question. Will people actually buy into it? Don Luthy, who works at that neighborhood apartment complex, says she would.
And I love the idea on people who, like me, who are not in a position to go out and put money in places to invest.
Luthy says she's going to invest 10 bucks a month and she's going to tell her neighbors to do the same thing. And that's exactly what John Haynes wants to hear. The guy behind the project says if it's successful, he'll take it nationwide. In Portland, Oregon, I'm John Sepulveda for Marketplace.
Now let's talk about the exact opposite of people who are asset poor, the 1%. No, you know what? Not even them. The 0.01% of the 1%. We're fascinated by how they live, what they do with all their money, and of course, how they got there. That last part is the topic of a new book that covers everyone from the robber barons of the Gilded Age in America to the tech billionaires of Silicon Valley. The book is called Wealth Secrets of the 1%, a modern manual to getting marvelously, obscenely rich. The book's author is Sam Wilkins, the head of business research at Oxford Economics, and he's here now. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
So, Sam, the title of this book suggests that it is a manual, an actual manual for getting marvelously rich. Is that the case?
Well, it is. In other words, it's a book about the economics of how people get incredibly rich and the factors that enable them to do so. But I think many people will find that the methods that are most successful are a little bit shocking.
In fact, sometimes to the extent of killing people, right? In terms of talk about the ancient Romans, who I was shocked to discover
accumulated mass wealth, or at least a few individuals did. But
well, exactly. I talk about one individual, Marcus Crassus, and modern consensus is that he's was worth about say $4 billion, so on the level of Donald Trump. But Crassus actually took property from his fellow Romans, and the way he did this was there was a legal device called prescriptions, and to be prescribed meant you lost not only your life but also your property. And so he was stealing not from, you know, some poor barbarian tribes on a foreign campaign, but stealing from fellow Romans who were, by at that point, the richest people in the world. So it was fabulously lucrative, and that made him, you know, tremendously rich. The ancient Greek historian Plutarch said Crassus got rich through fire and plunder, famously.
You definitely seem to be saying in this book that the way to succeed, the way to become super rich, a billionaire, is to ignore everything that is true about economics, right? That a naturally competitive market would have close to zero profit? Are you saying that to become a billionaire, you sort of necessarily have to cheat?
I wouldn't say that you have to cheat, but you certainly have to defeat the forces of market competition. The brutal fact of market competition is that it is your enemy if you want to get rich. So understanding that point, and understanding that what you have to do is to find some way to defeat the forces of market competition, like finding a market where there is a natural monopoly going to be created, absolutely. I mean, that is a real secret.
There are strategies that billionaires share. Did you also find similarities in their personalities or their life stories?
I did find a lot of these kind of similarities. One of these similarities, and this probably won't surprise you given what I've just said, is that they tend to be really merciless. And you don't think of Bill Gates as a merciless kind of fellow. But the thing is, if you're going into a market where there's really only going to be one winner, then you have to be not only absolutely confident that you're going to be that winner, you have to be untroubled by the prospect of wiping everyone else out. And one aspect of Bill Gates' personality is just that he is really ruthlessly competitive, or certainly was as he was coming up through the ranks. And, you know, he on a returning from a sales meeting, one of his fellow executives was really amused to find Bill Gates able to repeat to the decimal point the ownership shares of every CEO in the technology sector. And of course, Gates is the largest. So Gates is not only trying to compete with all of his competitors, he's trying to compete with people that he doesn't even have to compete with, you know, just a ruthlessly competitive kind of person. And that's really one personality trait that comes through a lot in the stories I tell.
You say that there are more than 1,600 US dollar billionaires in the world right now. How hard is it to get there?
Well, in a sense, it is easier than ever before because the number of billionaires added to the list last year, about 290, that is more billionaires than there were in the world in 1990. The best way to go about it may well be in the emerging world, which you wouldn't expect. But in the emerging economies, you see the same kind of combination that created the fortunes, for instance, of the U.S. robber baron era. You see rapid economic growth and weak regulation. And that's a combination that is really useful if you're trying to get obscenely rich.
Sam Wilkin is indeed the author of Wealth Secrets of the 1%, a modern manual to getting marvelously obscenely rich. Sam, thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure.
This final note before we go, a little more on the end of the financial industry's salad days. In its earnings report this week, JP Morgan announced smaller earnings, you heard that earlier, mainly because of lower commodity prices, lower mortgage income, and more than $1 billion in legal expenses. But it's also slimming down on purpose to avoid new federal regulations that would essentially punish it for being too big. So JP Morgan is enacting some, let's call them austerity measures. The first thing it's doing is dumping its expensive BlackBerry servers and even asking some employees to pay for their own phones. The Wall Street Journal reports that JP Morgan will also crack down on stays in five-star hotels. Some employees might be asked to share desks with people who work opposite shifts. And that's on top of worker layoffs, especially tellers, moving to cheaper offices, and even turning off fancy employee voicemail. And that is what austerity looks like in the banking world. finance guys without their BlackBerries. Sad. That's our show. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 0.9% today, or 157 points. The NASDAQ gave back 0.3%. That's 13 points. The S&P 500 let go 0.4%, or 9 points. Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm Molly Wood, and we'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.